Hey, welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Devin, and today on the pod, I had the pleasure to sit down with Aditi Juneja. She is a lawyer, writer, badass. She was named on Forbes 30 Under 30 on law and policy. And she is also the host of a fantastic podcast called Self-Care Sundays. We got to discuss her work with Protect Democracy, which is an organization dedicated to monitoring and pushing back on institutions and people that, as you would imagine, threaten our democracy. And she had so many smart and interesting things to say about this administration, how our democratic norms are backsliding, and then, of course, what she does for herself as self-care.
But really what we're trying to understand is not kind of like, for to be a little bit crass, not like how fucked up is it, but like how fucked up could it be, right? So like trying, so the numbers and threat is not, it's not a status of our current system, but it's a status of like, you know, how pliable is it? Like how bendy is this wood, basically?
Before we jump into the interview, I want to first do a little bit of feedback on Monday's episode, Men Are Fucking Trash. Drexel and I discussed the allegations against Eric Schneiderman, the former AG of New York, and the allegations that he abused women in his life. I am not going to get into a full feedback discussion today. I'm going to do that with Drexel on Monday. But there is one thing that I want to correct right off. I got an email from Katie. It was an email that we'll discuss on Monday, but there was a part of it that I wanted to talk about specifically. She said, quote, "Also a flag about language. It is preferable among domestic violence advocates to refer to the action as strangling rather than choking. Choking can happen if a piece of food goes down someone's windpipe. Strangling describes the violent action of one person towards another." And then she gave me a great resource on the language here. And I really appreciate you reaching out, Katie. Thank you so much. I want to correct this right off because it is something I said. I referred to it as choking. And it is important to use appropriate language when discussing violence and abuse. And I want to make sure I have it right. So thank you again. I will be sure to use strangling in the future because it is important to distinguish the two. And like I said, we'll have a full discussion on Monday about the feedback we've been getting about this, the past episode. And I'm sure it will be a lively discussion. I'm very excited to announce the Hellion of the Week for this week. Her name is Mandy Manning, which her name alone is awesome. And she is the 2018 recipient of the Teacher of the Year Award and was having absolutely none of Trump's bullshit. So let me list just a few ways that she was completely silently badass. She wore a Trans Equality Now pin, which is a, you know, obviously not something that Trump believes in. She did not applaud when Trump entered the room, even though she was sitting right next to Betsy DeVos, who did applaud. And she did not shake Trump's hand. I wouldn't either. Who knows where those have been? And she left a stack of letters from her immigrant students and told their stories in her speech and really honored them. And she said something really beautiful about them. She said, quote, "The thing about our immigrant and refugee students is that they have this innate hopefulness. They have gone through very, very difficult experiences, but they can see coming to the United States as an opportunity. They feel that they can have dreams and that they can potentially achieve those dreams. It's really quite beautiful, actually, because no matter what they experience, they still have this hope, this resilience." I just loved that. She also is just, I was reading this article about her and just her experience as a teacher and what she's done and how she's gone above and beyond. It is no surprise that she won Teacher of the Year. The New York Times highlighted a few of her students that she's helped through the years, and I'm going to repeat them here because I think it is worth singing the praises of badass women and making sure the world knows what they do. So one of her students was Safa from Sudan, who came to the United States at age 15 with a fourth grade education. And she graduated in high school. She graduated from high school in 4 years with the help of Mandy Manning. And she's now in college studying to become an elementary school teacher. There was a brother and sister from Syria who were both born deaf. They never learned any language, and they learned American Sign Language, as did Manning, on her weekends so she could help them, and they are both preparing to go to college. There was a man named Hussein from one student. Hussein from Iraq came to the newcomer center at age 20, and in Iraq he had cut hair for soldiers, and he realized that he could pursue it as a career. Every day after cosmetology class, he studied the day's lesson with Mandy Manning, who sought to make the subject more comprehensible for the new English speaker. And he's now a full-time stylist in San Diego. And there was a picture, and I believe it was him who was cutting Mandy Manning's hair, I believe for this. I'm not sure if it was for this event or not, but it was a really great picture. So she's just a wonderful example of a Hellion who's using her power for the good of those really underserved and ignored by this administration. And I am inspired by her. I'm inspired by the work that she does. I'm inspired how she used her position of power in this moment, in receiving this award, to make a statement and to stand up for her students. And she bringing those letters for Trump to read, even though she knows she's like, I don't know what's going to happen. She doesn't really expect them to be read. But just doing that is such an act of courage in and of itself. And that is the work of a true Hellion. Our guest today is Aditi Juneja, the host of the podcast Self-Care Sundays, writer and badass lawyer. She was named on Forbes 30 Under 30 list on law and policy. She was also a fellow at Longpath and a communicator at Project Democracy. Welcome, Aditi. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to speaking to you. So I want to start with your work for Protect Democracy, which is an organization that, quote, monitors, investigates, reports on, organizes, and litigates against any action taken by the executive branch that could erode the rules, practices, and freedoms that underpin our ability as a self-governing people to hold our leaders accountable. In short, we unite with Americans from all backgrounds and use every tool at our disposal to protect democracy. So what is your role there?
So I work in communications. So I was practicing as a lawyer. I was working for the government on fair and equitable housing. And I wanted to make a switch to be more involved in our present moment and in this present really what feels like a crisis in American democracy. So I switched over to Protect Democracy, and I joined in a communications role because I have a terrible saying, which is that if a policy falls in the woods and doesn't make a sound, no one hears it.
Right. I love that.
it's like the nerdiest phrase you can make up, but I think, but I think it's really important that people understand what is happening, what's being done, and also how the various pieces fit together. I think it can often feel like it's just one scandal after another. And, you know, democracy, in my view, doesn't die with a bang, it dies with a whimper. And so understanding how the pieces connect and the broader themes, I think, are really important.
Yeah, I really like that. Not with a bang, but with a whimper. That is very, it feels very salient because it's such a slow process. So can you explain the Democracy Threat Index that Protect Democracy uses?
Yeah, so the Democracy Threat Index is a tracker that we use in consultation with political scientists and various experts in this space. And it's not just political scientists. But really what we're trying to understand is not kind of like, for to be a little bit crass, not like how fucked up is it, but like how fucked up could it be, right?
Got
so
it.
Like trying so the numbers and threat is not, it's not a status of our current system, but it's a status of like, you know, how pliable is it, like how bendy is this wood, basically. So in some ways it is an assessment of our current status, but really what it's more is like, how dangerous is this current circumstance?
So what is our current score? Do you know? I'm kind of putting you on the spot here.
Yeah, I'm pulling it up right now. So we're at 34 right now.
So what is that high? Is that, what is that? What does that mean?
So it is, So a healthy democracy is between 0 to 12.5. Significant violations is between 12.5 and 37.5. And then there are more scary ones. It's on a scale of 0 to 100, where it's substantial erosion, near-term survival threatened, and non-democracy. So we're in significant violations. But it's broken down into categories. So that's media, executive constraints, elections, civil violence, civil liberties, and rhetoric. And we're not doing great on the rhetoric. The rhetoric is where we're starting to see some substantial erosion.
In this era of alternative facts, I imagine the rhetoric has broken down somewhat.
Yeah. And also, you know, there's some things where it's not just about the what I think is commonly thought of in terms of facts, but also some of the more basic things, like the fact that it's a threat to democracy when you stop considering your political opponents opponents and start considering them enemies. And right. that is not something we had seen as recently as the 2012 campaign. John McCain actually defended Obama when people said that he wasn't from this country or that he wasn't an American. And we don't see that anymore. In the 2016 election, we saw Donald Trump calling for Hillary to be jailed. You know, lock her up was a common chant. And I mean, that's kind of in the election context, but we still see that going forward in the present day as there's governing, where it's not language of this is a person who I have a fundamental disagreement with, but this is an enemy and this person is dangerous. And that's right. a different kind of thing.
Right. That's what Vladimir Putin does with his opponents in Russia.
Yeah, there are lots of examples. Yeah.
I feel like that one is very salient.
Yes.
So what are you currently working on? So what is your focus at this moment in terms of protecting democracy and the organization?
Yeah. So there are a number of things we're working on. One of them is the Joe Arpaio case, where Sheriff Joe Arpaio in Arizona was pardoned by the president. And recently in the Ninth Circuit appointed a private attorney to his case after the Department of Justice abandoned it. And so that case will be litigated and go forward. And we had filed the amicus to request for, along with some partners and co-counsel, to request that a private attorney be appointed in that case so that the facts and briefing could be presented to the court. We are working on some of the stuff around Mueller and Rosenstein. So, for example, there's a letter that we got, or a statement we had gotten signed by, at this point, well over 900 Department of Justice alumni, calling for respect of rule of law and for Congress to act if the president takes actions to obstruct the investigation. Lots of different things. These are the two things that are currently in my portfolio, but we have a lot of other things we're working on.
So what I'm going to ask you sort of a more general question. A lot of the discussion and rhetoric used is around weaponizing race and gender in this administration. So can you kind of speak to how that plays into maybe the two things in your portfolio specifically?
So the two things in my portfolio, it does play into them insofar as Joe Arpaio's criminal contempt conviction was a result of him violating a court order to stop violating constitutional rights of people, specifically through the lens of immigration enforcement, that as a sheriff, he was working in partnership with the federal government, which he's allowed to do, but it was kind of, I'm trying to think of the kindest way to say this, but the underlying facts were about kind of overextending
right.
his authority. That's what the court found, right? That's like not my personal opinion. It was that he was violating people's constitutional rights through the exercise of his authority as sheriff. And so, you know, there is, I think, a direct nexus to marginalized communities in the way that authoritarians try to delegitimize marginalized communities. And so, you know, the pardon of Joe Arpaio really exists in conflict, in our view, with the constitutional rights of the people who that criminal contempt by the court was meant to protect. On the Mueller and Rosenstein side, I think the nexus isn't quite as clear, but I think it still exists insofar as when you're talking about protecting rule of law and independence of law enforcement, those who are most often brought into our criminal justice system are those who are marginalized and those who have been systemically oppressed. And I think, you know, if that the president is not above the rule of law and no one else in our criminal justice system gets to choose their prosecutor or investigator or their judge or their jury or any of that. And so attempts to investigate, I think, undermine the rule of law broadly and undermine our faith in our justice system, that we are a nation of laws and not whims of individuals, that we kind of all exist. No one is above the law, that we all exist under those same laws. And I think there are plenty of folks for whom they like even the notion that that is currently the state of things would make them laugh. And I think that this is not helping.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, it really, it does feel like the kind of in this toolbox of disassembling democracy very slowly, you know, weaponizing race and gender has been used deftly by this administration.
To put delegitimizing marginalized communities is one of our kind of six ways that authoritarians work to create authoritarianism in a country. And really what you're what they're trying to do is to pit people against each other. It's a them versus us thing that, you know, in a democracy, you can't rule without the consent of the governed. But if the governed are all fighting with each other or distrustful of each other, that makes it much easier to rise to power.
What is one issue that you tackle or Project Protect Democracy in general is tackling that is kind of flying under the radar or not getting the news coverage that you think it deserves?
So we recently filed a complaint. I want to make sure that this is not one of my projects, so I'm checking to make sure that I'm gonna tell you the right facts. But there was a DOJ DHS report about terrorism and terrorism statistics. And it was, in our view, rife with inaccuracies. And there is a act that seeks to ensure, it's the Information Quality Act, that seeks to ensure that public reports put out by the government are accurate. And this report, I think, has a direct nexus to the Muslim ban, right? That if we have misinformation, how are we able to basically say or tell our government, like, that doesn't make sense. You're wrong. Those are not the most likely people to commit acts of terrorism in the United States, right? Like, it's very dangerous for the government to be putting out misinformation or disinformation. And one of the few tools we have to push back against this is this piece of legislation called the Information Quality Act, which basically has standards and methods and process for how information is put out.
It just, I hate to interrupt you. It just, I'm struck by how low of a bar this is.
Yeah, that's fair. But like, this is a thing that got almost no coverage, really flew below the radar. And, you know, the complaint refers to it as a particularly pernicious piece of disinformation. It's, you know, lots of inaccuracies and methodological flaws that are in violation with these standards that exist. And so we basically brought this complaint on behalf of the Brennan Center, saying that, you know, you need to pull this together. This is not done, and you can't lie to the American people.
Has the administration responded in any way, or has there been any response about lying to the American people? Which, again, at this point is just like, hey, it's a Wednesday. We're being lied to.
Yeah, well, the suit was filed on the 4th, so they haven't yet responded yet. And like in terms of legal tools, and because it hasn't gotten a ton of press coverage, there's not been a statement.
Right. Of course not. So is this level or this issue of democratic erosion new to this administration? Have there been instances in the past? Have there been past administrations that have increased the democracy threat level or a similar metrics? Is this new, or is this just in fast forward?
So I certainly don't think it's new. I think it's really important to point out that for the majority of this country's history, most Americans did not have democracy. It's only in the last 50 years post the Civil Rights Movement and the Civil Rights Act that all Americans were born with all of their rights. So, you know, a multiracial democracy where every citizen has all their rights is new to the United States in the last 50 years. So for sure, we have lots of instances where that's where it's not been the case that we've had democracy for some of the people. I think this feels new because it is blatant and it is populist in a way that we haven't seen before. Often we see our leaders operating within constraints of norms, even where laws don't exist. So for example, like releasing your taxes, that's a norm that there's no law that requires it. And we've seen our leaders largely abide by those norms. And so I think it feels new because it's a little bit odd to those of us who've been observing politics to think that one could disregard them so easily.
The norm busting has been the kind of thing that I've been most awestruck by, and the fact that it seems to go largely unnoticed or people don't seem to care that much. I'm like, excuse me, what are we doing here? Yeah. So I also want to ask you again, this is more of your opinion maybe, but we know that the fish rots from the head, which is one of Sarah's favorite expressions, but is Trump the logical extreme of the Republican Party or an extreme conservative movement, or is he an outlier?
That's a great question. I think it's actually less about party. And I think Trump is the logical conclusion of a increasingly polarized country.
Yeah.
So I think there are arguments, and I don't think I would have made this argument, but I think there are arguments to say that Obama was like a predecessor to Trump in some very natural ways, in the sense that he was really a celebrity. Like, people really loved Obama, right? Like, there was a cult of celebrity. He had written books. He didn't have a ton of experience. He was a one-term senator, right? There's like, I'm not comparing their intellect or their ability to govern. But what I'm saying is the idea that in previous generations, there were gatekeepers. The party would decide really who the candidate was going to be. And there are lots of people in the people who might think that, gatekeepers are bad. They keep certain types of people out. That's the reason all of our presidents have been white men. And like, we wouldn't have been able to have Obama without the removal of those gatekeepers. And that's likely true, but you also would not be able to have Trump without the removal of those gatekeepers. And so I think it's a combination of things. It's some of it is the tribalism and the fact that, our identities are now stacked within our political parties. So you used to have white Southern Democrats. We don't have them anymore, right? We used to have, our party identities were not so, if someone now tells me they're a Republican, you can guess demographically that they are likely white, that they're likely Christian, right? You can kind of guess some of these things about them that didn't used to be the case. So some of it is the tribalism. I think some of it is also the way our media environment has become increasingly tribalized. So, you and I wouldn't be talking on this podcast likely 20 years ago because no one would have given two women a radio show, right? Like 20 years ago, right? So there is, it's like awesome that we both have our own podcasts and are able to speak and communicate our ideas freely and share ideas. And there's real positivity that came out of that in terms of awareness and people being able to share their stories and their narratives. But it also means that we get to select our media. And my guess is that the people who listen to your podcast don't listen to, Rush Limbaugh, or Bill O'Reilly, or whoever the kind of, and so that means we're not all consuming the same information. So I think, I think I would be hesitant to say it's necessarily a natural conclusion of the Republican Party. And I think it's more about really the tribalism of both our politics and our media.
Yeah. I mean, I completely agree because, I really try to make this less about Republicans versus Democrats and make it more about ideology, but Republicans are making it hard to do these days. but you mentioned your podcast, which is excellent. It's called Self-Care Sundays, and it focuses discussion around, obviously, self-care. So why this topic?
So I had co-founded the Resistance Manual last year, and it was my first time really into activism, and it was, a hell of a way to start because I was running an organization of about 300 volunteers. So it was a lot. I think there are others who would say I was doing activism before then in the sense that, but it was more legal and more within kind of institutions. So this was different. And it was exhausting, and creating and founding something is exhausting. And I realized that I needed to prioritize kind of just like good habits and routines to make sure that I was restoring myself and taking care of myself. And I have epilepsy, I have a seizure disorder. And so, you know, my body kind of really forces me to take care of myself if I wouldn't, have done it otherwise. And I realized I didn't have great tools for that. And I was like, well, I'm going to like try to find out how you do that. And a lot of the resources that were available were about products and buying and selling stuff. And I was like, I don't need to spend money. I need like to like meditate. I need to sleep. Like I need, I'm like, you know what I mean? I needed a different set of tools. Like spending money was not going to like make me feel restored, I didn't think. Right. And I didn't also see great representation in the wellness and self-care space. So I was like, all right, like this is great if you have all the money in the world, but like, what do you do if you're a law student as I was, I was still privileged as a law student. I was like, what do people who are working 3 minimum wage jobs do to like restore right. and take care of themselves? And I didn't see that conversation happening anywhere. And so I decided to create it, and it was largely a self-interested venture where I was like, I need this information, and like, I can ask people nose your questions if I'm like creating a space to do it, right? Like it's less weird to be like, hey, tell me how you do this, if it's like formalized.
Yes.
But also I was very, again, privileged to have access to lots of great people who'd been doing this work for a long time who I could ask these questions to. And I thought, hey, I should like share their wisdom and knowledge with others.
Have you found any patterns in self-care in the people you've talked to, maybe particularly women or one group of people? Have you noticed patterns or something that comes up a lot?
Yeah. So the podcast is focused on women of color. So I was mostly talking to those folks and then some others. But I noticed several patterns. So in the first season, I was really just talking to people to try to understand how different types of people practice self-care. And what became really clear is that people really struggle with boundaries. And some of this is gendered, that women are not kind of afforded the same opportunities to create boundaries or are judged differently for doing so. And same thing for people of color. But boundaries are just really important for self-care, to be like, I'm not answering email after this time. No, I will not do that for you. Like the ability to say no and to set boundaries around how you will and will not spend your time, what you will or will not engage in, was just really crucial, particularly for those who had more public facing roles, because there were just endless opportunities to engage, especially in our social media environment.
Yeah, social media can be very overwhelming because you can say, no, yes, I'm not going to respond to emails after 6 p.m. But then you're like, I'll just check Twitter really fast. And 3 hours later, you're like, what have I done?
Yes, exactly. And like, you know, there's no like dearth of people who have responses to women on the internet with opinions.
Right? I feel like being a woman on the internet with opinions is just like the gateway to people telling you how to live your life. So What kind of self-care do you practice, if you don't mind sharing?
So I am still developing it. Actually, I wasn't sure I would do a season two, and I ended up doing a season two because I realized I had all these great ideas and was really bad at creating habits to actually do them. So I was like, I know all these things I should be doing, and I have no idea how to implement them into my daily life. So season two is all about habitualizing self-care because I'm not the best. And what I've been trying to... Some of the things that I've been trying to do is I did a lot of meditation last year, and I've done a lot of meditation. So I feel like I've gotten really good at being present. And so that allows me to focus on one thing at a time. And so I, you know, do different things to kind of help me do that. I have a journal with me almost all the time. So if something pops into my head, I can make a note of it and come back to it later, because information I don't think is safe in my brain. And also it makes it hard for you to be present when you're trying to remember things or not forget things. I really take my schedule one day at a time. So if you ask me what I'm doing tomorrow, what my schedule is like tomorrow, I have no idea the answer to that question. I really try to focus one day at a time so that I'm not constantly overwhelmed with things. Yeah. I schedule. So for me, I live in New York. I realized, I think sometime last year, that I was not taking advantage of that at all. And so I started like looking at discount theater tickets, and I try to go see a play or a musical or something once every couple weeks, because I find for me, that's just like a really different headspace to be in. It's away from the politics. It's no one. And also no one needs anything from me, and you are required to turn off your phone.
Right. So
it's like very different from being at home watching Netflix, because you're required to turn off your phone.
It's amazing how like, how being in spaces where you're not allowed to have your phone really changes
the dynamic. Mindset. Yeah. And also there's like a nice community feel to it, where it's like you're all experiencing this together. And so I really kind of enjoy that piece of it. And I've been trying to do yoga. So I've been making it to a weekly yoga class on Sunday evenings. I've not been doing great at exercising during the week. What else? And I've been trying to cook more. That's another habit I'm trying to get into. I mean, it is hard for me to build habits and not to just be like fully in my head. And so, you know, my podcast is like not a podcast of like an expert pretending to ask other experts questions that they already know the answers to. Mine is like truly me trying to like, please give me answers, because I don't know how to do this.
Yeah, I love that. Like, no, please tell me your secrets.
Yes, it's really not like, and I think you can tell when you like listen to it, because it's not like I ask the questions I think that like someone who's listening would be like, how the hell do you do that? Would ask, right. Because I also would like to know how the hell do you do that. Right.
I know. I for me, when I have guests, especially. You know, like you, like lawyers who know way more, I'm always like, I have 6,000 follow-up questions. So, because I have no idea what I'm talking about.
Saddle up. Like,
saddle up.
and I really did this season make an effort. I think in season one, it was, you know, when you're starting a new podcast, you're growing your listener base. It's challenging. Not everyone's like, I don't know if you have a real podcast or a fake podcast. Like it's kind of hard to have some credibility. But now with a season under a belt, I really was able to be more selective about guests. And I was really like, I don't want to talk to just like interesting or cool people, because not all of those people are great at self-care. I want to talk to people who I think like do this well and would actually have something useful to share.
We on the show, our version of self-care is we like to ask every episode, and we'd like to ask all of our guests for a gratitude check. We are living in weird and sometimes scary times. So Aditi, what gets you through the day?
The fact that I feel like I'm doing something about the scary times and that you know, not for nothing, I feel like I work for an organization where I'm really empowered to be heard, and where it's a really collaborative culture, and where I don't feel like I'm a cog in the machine, right? Where I feel really self-directed and have agency and have input into everything that we're working on. And that to me is a really wonderful feeling, to feel valued and respected that way. By the way, we're hiring. So if anyone is interested.
Hey,
but for me, it's really shocking to me. Like at the end of the day, how often I'm like, I'm just so lucky to work here. And so I actually send gratitude, like notes to our team all the time.
That's amazing. I love that.
Thank you guys. I'm so happy.
Y'all are the best. That's so fantastic.
Especially if you're young, like I'm a young woman of color. Like there are a lot of spaces where it would be challenging to be heard. And it's just really lovely to be in a space where that's not the case.
I love that. Well, Aditi, thank you so much for coming on the show today. This was fantastic.
Thank you so much for having me. I had so much fun.
Yeah. And you can follow Aditi at Aditi Juneja 3. You can follow Protect Democracy at Protect Democracy, but there's no E in protect. I'll link to it. And you can follow Self Care Sundays at Self Care Sundays. Like Aditi said, there's season 2. And I assume the episodes drop on Sunday, but I realized I didn't know. So I should probably ask.
Yes, they drop on Sunday.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you again.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, Hellions, that's it for me today. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Aditi as much as I did. I honestly could have talked to her for an hour or more, honestly. She's so smart and so well-spoken and knows way more about pretty much everything than I do, which is fantastic. It's always good to know people smarter than you. So thank you so much for listening. And I will be back here on Monday with Drexel. Like I said, we'll have a full discussion on the feedback we got from the episode Men Are Fucking Trash. But in the meantime, have a wonderful weekend, raise some hell, and remember to be kind.